Board, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, Director of Content at Steinway. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. This episode of Soundboard was recorded live from the Big Ears Festival, held each March in Knoxville, Tennessee. Go Vols! Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears. My guest today is the Grammy Award-winning ambient and electronic music composer Steve Roach. Roach taught himself the synthesizer at the age of 20, recorded his debut album 7 years later in 1982, and has been actively performing and recording his music ever since. I want to talk about Philip Glass for a minute.
Yes.
This will relate. So people call Philip Glass a minimalist, mm-hmm. which is not fair because there's more happening.
Yes.
He did a lot of studying with Ravi Shankar. He did a lot of studying with Indian music. Mm-hmm. And he made this transition from teleological or goal-oriented music to ateleological or not goal-oriented.
Right.
And I think a lot of his music, too, has to do with another ism called processism,
okay.
where it's extremely important as part of the audience to participate in this process from like sunrise to sunset. Mm. So at Big Ears this year, they're doing his music in 12 parts, and that's a 2-day live performance of that. Mm-hmm. One of my last piano recitals in the mid-aughts or so to a non-paying public was Philip Glass's Metamorphoses. And these pieces, over 6 or 7 minutes, maybe you gain one new chord by the end of it. Mm-hmm. But you really earn that chord.
Right.
You really earn that progression. So I saw your performance Thursday night. It was for 2 hours in a beautiful church in Knoxville with accompanying visual projections, and I felt that same sense of, oh, this is so important to experience live with other people, and to be here from the sun up to sundown over the course of 2 hours. I wonder if that's a fair description of what I witnessed.
Well, absolutely, it's fair, and it's the music that I create. I think it activates such individualistic responses in every person, and that's the beauty of it, is that it has that ability to, you know, essentially take its own form inside of the way you perceive, where other listeners would perceive it in a different way. But the element that I really love, the way that you intro'd that, is that I use this term essentialism in my music, because the elements that I use are all, over time, they've been distilled and expanded and developed and evolved over many, many years of performing and presenting this. It's not really so much a performance, but this kind of conjuring up, this kind of bringing in to a space through an incredible sound system and visuals, to where it's like all these essential elements of all these different aspects of working with the power of sound, working with sound before music, working with the primordial aspects of what my music contains. There's those elements that are just emerging out of the core of the earth, and then there can be this, you know, like last night I started with Scriabin's Mystic Chord, and then built off of this traditionally expansive, mystical, beautiful, simmering space. But there's a, as you heard through the development of 2 hours, there's a wide dynamic range of, you would call it sound design, perhaps in the film industry or something like that. The sounds are intentionally woven in to break down sense of linear time and to open up more of what I like to refer to as that diving into the mythic imagination, where your mind will hear these sounds, but they don't have a reference of where they're coming from. It's not like with Philip Glass, you see his ensemble, they're playing instruments. It's all emerging out in a sense that where you can catalog that logically. But when you hear and see me, because I'm playing real instruments in terms of modern electronic gear, synthesizers, you know, the keyboards connected to them or not, other instruments that are triggered through devices, but they're instruments nonetheless, and they have a tactile feeling to them, and I'm working with them. But for an audience in these settings where we're in a church space, where they map the visuals, and that becomes another layer of harmonic contribution to everything that's happening. So,
okay, I'm glad you talked about the triggering of instruments and the live playing of other instruments. So I imagine if you have, like, you have a 2-hour time scale, you know there are these musical events that you're going to hit, and I imagine that there's some visual elements in this case that are triggered with those. So how much is pre-planned? Are there like traffic lights along the way? How much is improvised? What freedoms do you have as something like this is unfolding?
Yes, that's a great question. And I wish I would have brought the set list map, so to speak, which is it's very precisely listed out over 2 hours. And the opening invocation, and then spirals of desire, and then the Prometheus passage, and Magnificent Gallery, and, you know, the titles of pieces that are originally from perhaps my albums, my recorded work. But I create a very specific arc, almost like a classic journey of what I would think of in a, like, the hero's journey sort of piece from Joseph Campbell, who I've really drawn so much inspiration from. So there's very clear design of embracing and welcoming you as an audience member. You know, we're sitting around the fire, and it's like I'm very aware of having this place where you kind of settle in, and everybody's flown in or walked in or driven in or been dropped off from a car or whatever, but we're all there. I always start my live experiences in that mode, where we're coming together as a multidimensional tribal family of sorts. You know, I'm really connected to that sense. And sometimes I'll just, if I'm announced there, I'll come out and I'll just kind of like welcome people, but in a nonverbal way, and just, here we are.
What makes up your tonal palette going into a performance like this? You know what instruments you have, you know what you're drawing on. Mm-hmm. How do you determine what lives in any particular orchestra for the night?
Right. Well, that comes from the palette of colors, i.e. instruments, i.e. synthesizers, acoustic instruments, the sound that I design through my own imagination and through my own skills. But I'm using hardware synthesizers, hardware equipment with a feel to them. They have a tactile feel the way a classical instrument would feel. Every instrument has its own kind of soul that is emerging from it. My wife, Linda Kohanoff, was very active music journalist for over years, but she plays viola, and she has her own connection with different bodies of traditional wood, and now she has a 5-string carbon fiber, and they all have this quality of not only feel, but ultimately the sound. So the instruments that I bring out live still, there's folks that know the instruments that I'm using, and they're just bewildered that I would bring those out, because they're so, some of them are 30 years old, you know.
And some of them are esoteric in terms of the traditional orchestral landscape.
That as well. And then if the modern electronic culture that's now become really sophisticated, and you have all age groups of people creating amazing music, and many of them are creating music on exactly what you're recording this interview on, which is a laptop.
Right.
And a mouse and a controller,
right?
Which that's an area that is a no-go zone for me, because I mean,
why is that?
Because in early electronic music concerts, I would experience those as that, where you would come in and you would hear a great, incredible composition, and everybody's very seriously listening, and the artist is up there with the reel-to-reel, you know, Morton Subotnick and that sort of thing, and then they're playing that. And that's active listening, and it's doing what we've already talked about in a lot of ways. But you're listening to a moment in time that happened somewhere last week or last year or somewhere. So what I'm doing is bringing out that aspect of deep listening, to borrow that term from Pony Oliveris, but to bring in that aspect, but to be able to absolutely respond, where I can shape and spontaneously just make a complete directional shift. If I feel something really emerging, then I can just completely morph out of that space into another living, breathing zone. So there's the emotional connection that I have. I mean, there's many times where my body is just is tingling and my eyes are watering from pure emotion that's getting activated. And so all of that, and then feeling the audience. So all of that allows me to have those kind of sudden changes in direction. And but the roadmap itself over 2 hours is definitely very, very highly sophisticated in the way that, that it has a landscape. And then it always comes into a place where it's integrative. And you have this period towards the end where all of that you, what you experience is being then integrated and being absorbed. And I'm not leaving people out in the dark night of the soul. But we've gone through that, and we've gone through magnificent voids, and we've gone through delicate worlds, and and all of that. But it's after doing these kind of creating these experiences for almost 45 years or something. I mean, there's like an incredible depth of knowing how to create these maps of consciousness and perception and sensuality and primal fear and all of that stuff. I live for that in music as well. Well, any kind of music, I want to hear that and feel that.
So what I'm hearing is, while there are premeditated points, musical events,
compositions
through composed, you in no way want to hem yourself in to where you cannot spontaneously react and create while these performances are unfolding.
Exactly.
To put it on a really base level, I live in Berlin. And if you're at a club and the DJ just plays his 90-minute set and occasionally does some crossfading, he's not reacting to the crowd.
No,
he's not feeling the energy.
Right.
And then it's like, I might as well pop in a CD or a Spotify playlist, whatever the equivalent
would be. That's what is happening. And then in that case, with a lot of these massive raves and that sort of thing, you've got a guy up there who's kind of like a ringleader. There's emotional movement and he's, you know, doing all that stuff. But right, it's still baked. It's like comes out and it's fully formed already.
So let's go farther back in the creative process, because this is something that you have come to over the decades. And I guess I would be interested in the creative process of how are we coming up with the compositions in the first place? What does the process look like there?
Yeah, the process is, it's born from the sensuality and the power and the primordial forms and energy of, I would say, my connection to the sound, the way it's affecting my physicality and in my consciousness. And also where I live in Baja, Arizona, southern Arizona, below Tucson. And so since my earliest memories of being drawn towards expressing a feeling that had to be expressed, it wasn't just casual. It was being activated through being out in the desert and the expansiveness of the desert and the temperament of the desert, the drama of storms and all of that. So there's that kind of a piece that also has been a constant through line. But in terms of designing and creating these sounds, they're really, it's quite often like I'll enter into that space with a tabula rasa state of mind where I'm just open and I have this whole gathering of perceptional memories and instinctual desires that are drawn towards creating certain harmonic forms. And I'm self-taught. I do not read music and I did not go through any kind of formal music training or conservatory or study with anybody directly, but I just have, from the very beginning, I would always be drawn to sound and music that had this, and I'll use the word primordial again if I haven't already a dozen times, but there's this kind of feeling in there that activates my imagination to then start blending and creating and mixing my own palette of colors. And so that becomes, over years, it becomes more and more sophisticated. And then the harmonic forms that I'm working with and just this intuitive understanding, like the things I was doing harmonically in the last three nights were not available to me 2 or 3 years ago. Just the pathways that are opening up and the way that I'm combining particular chords and textural aspects inside of there. And part of that, the complexity of my music is that part of those, of the sounds that I create that are more non-tonal, but there's an energy inside of them. And then there'll also be some kind of quality in there that directs you towards a tonal center or a sense of suspension or dissonance. But then I'm playing with a lot of those energies all the time too. So I'll create immense sense of drama being completely ungrounded, and then I'll come back and just bring it right back into a gorgeous, massive chord. So with the instruments that I have, I can create these massive chords or these beautiful, delicate sounds, and then I can spend maybe weeks and some, like the sounds that you heard in the concert have been in my one Oberheim analog expander synthesizer for 33 years. So those sounds also, they continue to be as if I'm flying to Knoxville with my favorite cello, and I've got, you know, this viola that I've had for 50 years that's been with me through life and all that. Because you have maybe 100 instruments, not sounds, but you have sounds that are inside the synthesizer, which used to be considered cold and just not really emotionally activating. But most essential piece is space, is the space that that sound lives in. It's like the acoustic body of a Stradivarius, mm-hmm. for example. We just were at the Musical Instrument Museum in Scottsdale. Unbelievable. Have you been there?
No, I have not.
Oh, my. I was just talking about that with Michelle Moog, the daughter of Robert Moog, this
mm-hmm.
morning.
Mm-hmm.
And that museum, I mean, we just saw the Stradivarius exhibit that had everything from all the history of that. So at the same time, we go upstairs, and then they have all the Oberheims and a lot of the synths that I'm speaking about in that timeline of instruments that we are using as a motive.
It sounds like we're talking about resonance, mm-hmm. and that it's important for you. I think, again, this also benefits live performance of your work,
mm-hmm.
is the warmth of the resonance,
yes.
is there. And synths are not what they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's not an ice cold, like I'm thinking of the synth pop movement in the 80s,
right.
where it's like, oh, yeah, I know that sound. That's what it is, right?
Right. And
what I experienced from your performance was a spinning spinning sound and a warmth that gradually shifted.
Nice.
You know, like plates,
yes.
From one to the next.
Right. And that, to finish that thought on space, is that, and the synth that I'm, that one of my signature instruments that I just spoke of, the Oberheim, for example, when I created Structures from Silence, that was on a 1984 Oberheim OB-8.
Mm-hmm.
I still have that instrument, and its brothers and sisters were with me here. But the thing that's consistent from then to now is I use an external, the Lexicon Reverb, and that is like the holy grail of putting any kind of instrument into a space, and then I can design and create a cathedral within the cathedral. So there's an immense amount of expansiveness. So that's part of when you hear my live sets, is that you're feeling like the boundaries of where music usually lives more intimately. I can have that as well, as you heard. Playing the synths through, that's in my setup, and I have maybe 20, 23 seconds of reverb at certain points. The high, immediate, mid, and low frequencies can be expanding out, and so through the set, I'm changing the size of the space that we're inhabiting in that section of the set. Like, for example, the flute's a Slovakian fujara.
Okay.
It's a Slovakian overtone flute. So then I'll bring in something like that where it's, you know, it has breath. It has that primordial deep impact. You can hear it and feel like you're moving through time. And then I weave these different ocarinas from pre-Hispanic instruments or, you know, my connection to Australia and didgeridoo and that sort of sound, bring all of that added too. I mean, I was even using rocks in the more primordial aspect of the set. So again, those sounds and the way they're processed, if there was no reverb, it wouldn't happen. It could happen, but it would not have the psychological, emotional expansiveness or delicateness or overwhelming aspects.
Is the reverb the special sauce that allows us to blend synth and organic instruments?
Absolutely so. So there, that's the equalizer. When you put it all in, you create it and put it in that space, and that's why playing in these really magnificent, beautiful, sacred spaces
with built-in reverb.
Right, with verb. So your people are saying, well, you must not have to use so much reverb. And it's like, well, absolutely, that's not the case. And the case in point is that in Arizona, there's the Biosphere 2. Do you know what most people on the planet know about that now? That it's like the second version of a planet that they were, you know, developing as an experiment. So I know people at U of A that now are managing that facility. So 3 weeks ago, I was invited out by the director of the Andrew Weil Institute for Integrative Medicine. But we went into what is called the lung, and there's two giant structures there that look almost like UFOs that are massive. And those are the lungs that contained environment is expanding when it gets hot. We went in there with Birenbaum and my didgeridoo, and when he showed me a picture of it, I said, bring your Birenbaum, because there's going to be some reverb in that space, and it's incredible. And so it was. So that recently, just a few weeks ago, I was able to experience a quality of reverb I've never heard anywhere. You could just make one sound out of your mouth and it would just hover in there, that sort of thing.
And all the overtones that come with it.
Right, and then you're playing off of that. So it was a real study in just hearing what a natural space like that. It was fantastic.
Are these soundscapes that you're creating at the end of the day, are you comfortable with that term when speaking about your music and what you do?
Yeah, I would say that's part of the language. You know, it's fairly open and expansive. Soundscapes can enter into like an immersive realm. I have albums called the Immersion Series, and it's a beautiful, shimmering space that sustains, and that's what it does for 70 minutes. If you change the core of that, then it takes it out of that place. So to me, that's like creating a fragrance, like a homeopathic dosage, where it's really subtle. Present workshops where I'm talking about active, deep listening, and then I'll have an immersive space playing when everybody comes in, and it's on very low. And I'll be explaining that, and then I'll just kind of casually walk over to the mixer, and then I just pull the volume down, and then it's like everybody gasps. Like up until that point, that sound was so almost imperceptible. And then when it's gone, and then that you realize, when I'm using that as an example, I speak to the nature of using music also as a way to create a state-specific sense of warmth and safety and security. If you live in a big city and you have all the noise going on and all the sounds of the building itself and all that, but if I have an immersive soundscape type of piece that's not so dramatic or covering all these vast ranges of emotion, but you have something that's functional in a sense, that can really be real positive aspect in your mental health and in your nervous system. So I would have categorized soundscape music as immersive and non-invasive, where you don't have to be actively listening to it, but you know, you're resonating with it.
When you do a performance like you did at the church, or when you put out an album with a 70-minute through line on it, mm-hmm. What would you like as the effect for a listener? What would be the best outcome from someone who hears or experiences?
Based on the nature of the piece itself, it would be a deep peace. It would be like a congruent atmosphere to feel nourished in. That would be the desire around pieces that are directly created for that kind of support and that kind of congruency. And then I have other pieces like Darkest Before Dawn. They're still nourishing, but they kind of open up another portal into a deeper, different kind of place. But they're still very minimal in their soundscape, so to speak. Then they're designed that when you play them in loop mode on your phone or in your system or however you're delivering music into your life, the fades down and up are so slow that you could just walk away for a moment, and you'll never hear where that happens.
You told me about a bit of a harmonic epiphany you had a couple of years ago, where you're now able to make harmonic shifts that you didn't possess the ability to do before. Mm-hmm. I wonder, over the decades, if there were other discoveries or epiphanies that you had in trying to reach this pinnacle of what you're trying to put out musically.
It's a constant onion skin. As I grow deeper into time i.e. getting older, but I like to grow deeper into time. And then the amount of time that I invest and spend, you know, I use that word again, you know, what you waste, you spend, you invest, you immerse in time. The amount of time that I'm in that current is immense. I mean, 15 hours a day sometimes, and I'll play long sessions. If you're a bodybuilder, and you get this kind of strength that's physically witnessed by how much time you devote to that. And so for me, the time I've devoted to exploring sound at its most primordial level, developing my own techniques and my own direction with harmonic forms and consonants and dissonance, and working with certain clusters and certain keys and combining those. Like Rothko, I love the Rothko's work. There's that sense of mixing colors, and it's very organic, and it's something that you take note of, and then the deeper you go into it, the more it reveals itself. And then that's where the layers of the skin get deeper and deeper into things that I was doing 30 years ago, which were, I wouldn't say simpler. I mean, Structures from Silence, which is still celebrated as one of my most loved pieces, was all based on a Lydian scale in C. Breathing, diaphanous, real minimal, just timeless, that sort of thing. But now I'll take those understandings and then combine other root notes or other clusters and go against the grain of what I would normally not do.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard a clip from Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat, from their album The Age of Consent on London Records. Underpinning this interview is the title track from Steve Roach's Structures from Silence, the 40th anniversary remaster, on Fortuna Records. Our opening music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush on a Steinway Model M, played by me, Ben Fanan. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Message me on Facebook at Steinway, or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears Festival. Thank you for listening.